All right, I'd like to pick up where we left off in the book of Joshua. We left off in chapter 19. And, of course, this is just one of those chapters where it's just bumper-to-bumper names of places and boundaries and cities and all of these other type of things, which I think on the surface a lot of people just completely overlook because they feel like, well, it's just a bunch of useless information that has been recorded centuries ago and has no relevance for us today. But again, I always like to just preface when we're going through these books what Paul tells us in Galatians 3 about the fact that this is our tutor, and it really is trying to teach us something. And when we read all of these different things, keep something in mind. I mean, we're reading about the Promised Land now. Everything has a spiritual significance to it. Everything has a spiritual parallel or symbolism to it. And we're talking about the Promised Land now and how God is dividing up the inheritance that every tribe is going to get. And he goes to great lengths to give us the borders and the boundaries of these. But keep something in mind. What we see on this map here, where God basically mets out through the lot, he mets out this land. This is only really a fraction of the land that God had promised Abraham back in the book of Genesis. Basically, God said that he was going to give Abraham's descendants the land from the river of Egypt, which may even been the Nile, all the way to the Euphrates River. So we're talking over 600 miles. If you look on that map there, the land that they were given, as far as from north to south, it only ran about 180, 200 miles at the most. And the land across, I mean, if you look at it from this perspective, from the Mediterranean Sea all the way across, even the largest point, I mean, it's about 100 miles or so. Well, they don't even possess even a fraction of that today. Matter of fact, in the Six-Day War, when they got the Golan Heights, they got to the West Bank and they got the Gaza Strip. Almost all that stuff, they're just giving back now in concessions. And they have, you know, some of the territory that they have today, as far as Israel's concerned, it's only about 2 miles wide. I mean, it is really a tiny little nation. But God said in Zechariah that in the end times, towards the end of the world, it would become a burdensome stone to the whole world. And you can hardly look at the news or read the newspaper without seeing Israel right in the center of the world. It's a burdensome stone, and you can't move it. It's an immovable stone. And I mean, it's really amazing. If you take a look at the history of Israel, by all the laws of men and nation, they shouldn't even be in existence today. To me, just one word proves as a God. If you were to say Jew, to me, shows conclusively there's a God, because there's no way they should be in existence. From their history, they have been hated from their inception. Look at them today. They are surrounded by these Arab nations that just absolutely hate them. The Arabs just have one goal, and that's to drive them into the sea. And you wonder sometimes, why are they so hated? And you gotta say, hey, you know what? This is a spiritual thing. This is spiritual. The devil hates all men, and he hates all nations, but he has a real intense hatred and contempt and malice towards Israel, because it's through Israel that God has basically redeemed man. I mean, it was God revealed his laws and his ordinances and his statutes through the Jews. That Jesus Christ came through the Jewish people. He was a Jew. Satan just hates this nation with a passion. You know, that's why when you look at things, you always got to look at the spiritual symbolism, and you always got to ask how does this apply. So anyway, I don't want to keep rambling here, but God has already meted out a number of the tribes. He vetted out, okay, the tribe of Manasseh, the tribe of Gad, and the tribe of Judah. They had got their inheritance, and Reuben and Judah got their inheritance. But there were seven other tribes that needed to get their inheritance. And so they went out and they basically mapped out the land, and then they divided it up, and then they were to cast lots for it before the Lord, and then he was going to divide these nations up. Now, I think what's kind of interesting when you read this chapter 19, it talks about Simeon. It says, then the second lot fell to Simeon, to the tribe of the sons of Simeon, according to their families, and their inheritance was in the midst of the inheritance of the sons of Judah. Now, here's what I want to, just before we even get into the border lines of Simeon, I think it's kind of interesting. If you go back to the book of Genesis, in Genesis 49, when Jacob is blessing his sons, he said this about Simeon, and he said this about Levi. And I thought it's very, very fascinating, because it's a prophecy that was made centuries before Moses even came on the scene. But he said this of Simeon and Levi. He said, Simeon and Levi are brothers. says, their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly. Because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob, and I will scatter them in Israel. Now here's the thing. I don't have time to get into this, but you know, when we went through Genesis, I think in chapter 35, we read about how Jacob's sons, Levi and Simeon, they basically slew Shechem and all the men of this particular city because Shechem had defiled their sister. And, you know, they had entered into a covenant with these people, and then they ended up slaying them. And then apparently they hamstrung oxen just for the fun of it. I mean, these guys had a real mean streak in them. And Jacob said, of these two tribes, he said that may they be scattered throughout Israel. And Levi is not given any land at all as their inheritance. They are scattered throughout Israel as a priestly tribe. But then Simeon, he ends up getting part of the land of Judah. He's below Judah here, if you see it on this map. But this was actually Judah's whole portion. But Judah ended up giving him a portion of their land down there in the Negev by the kind of the bordering on the desert. And eventually, you know, if you look at these other maps, I mean, at the time of, at the time of Christ and everything, you don't even see Simeon here. He's just completely absorbed in the tribe of Judah. And, you know, I say that in passing, but it's like, isn't that amazing that Jacob would make that prophecy about these two sons, and it's being fulfilled right to the T, even though Simeon is allotted specific land. In the end, he was basically dispersed throughout Israel. But of course, he's still a tribe today. Of course, nobody knows who belongs to what tribe, but we know that for certain because if you go to the 7th chapter of the book of Revelation, you know, at the end of the world, there's going to be 12,000 from each tribe of Israel, which would be the 144,000 who will be, you know, witnesses for Jesus Christ during the tribulation period. So God hasn't forgotten them, and they're still, you know, they still have their lineage from their tribes, even though they don't know it now. They will when Christ returns. Anyway, I didn't want to, you know, beat that to death either, but keep that in mind when we're going through this chapter 19, because now he gives the borderlands of the tribe of Simeon, where he says in this verse 2, he says, so they had as their inheritance Beersheba or Sheba and Moleda and Hazar Shua and Baalah and Ezem and El Tulad and Bethhol and Hormah and Ziglag and Beth Markaboth and Hazar, Susa, and Bethlehemoth, and Sharuhen, 13 cities with their villages, Ain, Rimmon, Ether, and Ashan, 4 cities with their villages, and all the villages which were around these cities, as far as Baal-Lehbir, Ramah of the Negev. This was the inheritance of the tribe of the sons of Simeon, according to their families. The inheritance of the sons of Simeon was taken from the portion of the sons of Judah, for the share of the sons of Judah was too large for them. So the sons of Simeon received an inheritance in the midst of Judah's inheritance. You know, what's another interesting thing? If you go back to Deuteronomy chapter 33, Moses gives a blessing upon each tribe, but I think what's kind of conspicuous by his absence when we went through Deuteronomy chapter 33 is he doesn't even mention Simeon. And I think that's kind of significant too, because remember we went through the book of Numbers. They took two censuses. They took a census when they first came out of Egypt, and when they first came out of Egypt, Simeon was one of the largest tribes. But by the time they finished wandering around the desert, they were one of the smallest tribes. They had lost a great deal of their population, and I think that one of the reasons is suggested, or at least is implied, when you read the book of Numbers, is that that tribe was basically the one that was responsible for the sin in Baal of Peor, where the people got involved with the Moabite women, and they got involved in idolatry, and then God in one day slew 23,000 people. Well, you get the impression there that it was the tribe of Simeon that led them into that type of idolatry. So, you know, I think that it says a lot. Here is Simeon. He started out really well when he first came out of Egypt, but then he ends really badly. And I think that says a lot. I mean, some people can start out really well in their Christian walk, But it's not so much how you start out, it's how you're going to finish this race. I mean, Paul, when he wrote his second letter to Timothy, that was his last epistle, he basically said, I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race. He said this just before he died. I mean, it's kind of like that's what really matters, is how we're going to finish this race. I remember when he did say in that second epistle to Timothy, he said to Timothy to send John Mark to him because John Mark was good for him. And remember that when John Mark, in his beginning Christian walk, he blew it. He fell flat on his face. He deserted Paul and Barnabas on their first missionary journey. And Paul didn't want to give him another chance. But because of Barnabas, he was given another chance and he proved himself. But then we read about another guy named Demas. He apparently started out real well, but he didn't finish too well because Paul said that he deserted him for the love of the present world. So in other words, I think that in the end, our inheritance, and this, we're talking about now about a Christian inheritance, a spiritual inheritance, we're talking about a heavenly inheritance. It's determined, our heavenly inheritance is determined on how well we finish this race, as far as what our rewards are going to be. I think it does say a lot in that regard. I think this is what it's pointing to. Because keep something in mind, too. I just mentioned back when God told Abraham how much land he was going to give them. Well, they have never received that much land at any time in their history, not even in their zenith under Solomon and under David. And that says something too, that we will never receive our full inheritance this side of eternity. And I think that's what it's pointing to. But you see that Simeon started out really good and he finished really bad, unfortunately for him. Now this verse 10, we deal with the tribe of Zebulun because it says, now the third lot came up for the sons of Zebulun according to their families, and the territory of their inheritance was as far as Zarid. Then the border went up to the west and to Mar-Elah, and it touched Dabesheth and reached to the brook that is before Jonikaim. Then it turned from Zarid to the east towards the sunrise as far as the border of Krish Loth Tabor, and it proceeded to Dabirath and up to Japhia. From there it continued eastward towards the sunrise to Gath Hepher, to Ethkazim, and it continued to Rimmon, which stretches to Neah. The border circled around it on the north to Hanathon, and it ended at the valley of Iftahel. Included also were Kete and Nahalah and Shimron and Idala and Bethlehem, 12 cities with their villages. This was the inheritance of the sons of Zebulun according to their families, these cities with their villages. What's also kind of interesting, when it talks about Zebulun, there was a prophecy made about Zebulun. I don't know if you can see it here, but there's Zebulun right here, and here's Naphtali here. When we get into that, here's the Sea of Galilee here. But there was a prophecy made about Zebulun and Naphtali that was made in Isaiah. I believe it was Isaiah. Isaiah 9. It says this about them. As a matter of fact, it's quoted in Matthew 4. But it says this about Zebulun. It says, the people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine upon them. Thou shalt multiply the nations, and thou shalt increase their gladness. They will be glad in thy presence, as with the greatness of the harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. And what's interesting is that's basically quoted in Matthew 4:15 about Zebulun. In Matthew 4, it says this. It says, the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali by the way of the sea, beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who were sitting in darkness saw a great light. To those who were sitting in the land of the shadow of death, upon them a light dawned. What's he talking about? If it's right there around the Sea of Galilee, and it's talking about these people are going to see a great light, put two and two together. What is it talking about?
Jesus?
Yeah, it's talking about when Christ comes on the scene, they're going to see a great light, because Jesus himself said that he is the light of the world, right? I think that that's pretty significant. Anyway, that was a prophecy made of Zebulun. Also, I don't have time to get into this tonight, but if you have a chance, go back and read chapter 49 of Genesis. I was going to try to read all the different prophecies there that Jacob made about each one of his sons. But in Zebulun, he basically said that they would be really blessed as far as their trade routes would be concerned, things like that. And, you see how the prophecy fulfilled there? Anyway, beginning with that, verse 17. He says that a fourth lot fell to Issachar, the sons of Issachar, according to their families. Their territory was Jezreel and included Chizuloth and Shunem. and Hapharaim and Shion and Nahath and Rapheth and Kishhion and Ebez and Remeth and Enganim and Enhada and Beth-Haz-Ez. The border reached to Tabor and Shehazuma and Beth-Shemesh, and their border ended at the Jordan, 16 cities with their villages. This was the inheritance of the tribe of the sons of Issachar, according to their families and their cities with their villages. And, you know, here again, I think, why does the Holy Spirit go to such lengths as far as giving us all these details, all these cities and stuff like that? I think the spiritual application is the fact that, hey, man, God does met out rewards as far as our inheritance is concerned. When I'm talking about inheritance, I'm talking about rewards that God is going to met out to people. And who can tell me, and who remembers, what was the basis upon how they divided up the land? Who remembers?
The size of the tribe.
Yeah, the size of the tribe determined, you know, what size of the portion they were going to get. All right, the size of the tribe pointed to basically their fruitfulness, okay, as far as their population, right? Well, it's the same thing to us spiritually. The more fruitful we are this side of eternity for the honor and glory of God, for the salvation of souls, the edification of the church, the more fruitful we are in the eyes of God, the greater our inheritance is going to be in heaven. That's what it's pointing to. Anyway, now we're getting into the tribe of Asher. Asher means happy. He was one of the sons of Leah. And verse 24 says, now the fifth lot fell to the tribe of the sons of Asher according to their families. Their territory was Helkath and Halai and Beten and Akshaf and Alamelech and Amad and Mishal. And it reached to Carmel on the west and to Shihor-Libnath. It turned towards the east to Beth Dagon and reached to Zebulun and to the valley of Iph-Tahel, northward to Beth Emek and to Ne'iel. Then they proceeded on the north to Kabul and Ebron and Rehob and Hamon and Cana as far as the great Sidon. The border turned to Ramah and to the fortified city of Tyre. Then the border turned to Hosa, and it ended at the sea by the region of Akzib. Included also were Yuma and Aphek and Rehob, 22 cities with their villages. This was the inheritance of the tribes of the sons of Asher according to their families, these cities with their villages. You know, I don't know if you can see it that well on this map, but this is Asher right here. Jacob basically, you know, predicted that he would be really fruitful in his land, his territory. And you can see right there, he's right along the seacoast, and because of the tremendous sea trade that was going on there, he was really blessed monetarily or as far as riches were concerned and wealth was concerned. But here's, keep something in mind too, all right? It was Jesus who said, what does it profit a man if he gained the whole world, lost his own soul? Look around us today, and I look at, we got, you know, elections coming up in less than 2 weeks, and, you know, I just dread it, don't you? And you look at all the ads, and you read all the things, people are just slinging mud left and right, aren't they? And, you know, I'm thinking to myself, man, I wouldn't want any part of that dogfight, because in the end, who did Jesus say is going to inherit the earth?
The meek.
The meek shall inherit the earth. And you read what happens in the book of Revelation, and you read what the prophets have foretold, especially some of the major prophets, minor prophets, in regards to what's going to happen at the end of the world. God is going to purge this world of its unrepentant sinners. And it's going to be the meek ones are going to be the ones that are really going to be blessed. They're going to be the ones that inherit everything. I don't know if you ever heard of that missionary down in Ecuador in the 50s. His name was Jim Elliot. He said something to the effect that it says, a man is no fool to give up that which he cannot keep in order to gain that which he cannot lose. You know, and we got to say, how much we may accumulate in this life, we can't keep it. And I think that all these inheritances point to the fact that, hey, there's a heavenly inheritance, all right, that we can never lose, you know. Beginning with verse 32, now we're getting into the tribe of Naphtali. It says, the sixth lot fell to the sons of Naphtali, to the sons of Naphtali according to their families. Their border was from Heleph, from the oak in Zaananim, and Adinekeb, and Jabneel as far as Lakum, and it ended at the Jordan. Then the border turned westward to Asnath Tabor and proceeded from there to Hukko, and it reached to Zebulun on the south, and it touched Asher on the west, and to Judah at the Jordan towards the east. The fortified cities were Zidim, Zir, Hamath, Rakath, and Chinnereth, and Ad-Ama, and Ramah, and Hazor, and Kadesh, and Ed-Rei, and En-Hazor, and Urion, and Migdol, Horem, and Beth-En-Ath, and Beth-Shemesh, 19 cities with their villages. This was the inheritance of the tribes of the sons of Naphtali, according to their families, the cities with their villages. And remember I said that Naphtali, as well as Zebulun, they were predicted that they would see a great light. Because right around that area, Jesus did most of his miracles. That was basically his base of operations. It was his springboard in which he did most of his preaching. And the people there, they saw a great light. Unfortunately, a lot of people rejected that light. And remember what Jesus said in the Gospel of John, in the third chapter of John. He said that people prefer darkness rather than light. Why? Because their deeds are evil. Right? So even though those people saw a great light, unfortunately for a lot of them, it really put them under just that much more judgment. Because, you know, the Bible says whoever has been given much, much is going to be required of him. And the light that was given to them was so great that Jesus had basically rebuked the city of Capernaum, which is right around that area there. He said, do you think you're going to be exalted to heaven? You're going to be brought down to hell. And then he basically said it's going to be more tolerable on the day of judgment for Sodom and Gomorrah than it's going to be for those people who saw this great light. Because he made it abundantly clear that if the miracles had been performed in Sodom and Gomorrah, it would be remaining to this day. People would have repented. So, I mean, I think it says a lot, even though these two tribes basically were given so much light. And look at how our country is today. Look at the light that we've been given as far as spiritual light. I mean, you know, we got churches almost like on every corner, like gas stations. And you can go in any bookstore and buy Bibles or extra biblical literature or any kind of things to point you to God. We've been given a great light, but I'm telling you, just like Capernaum, the light that was given to Zebulun and Naphtali, it only brought in more judgment for them. And the end. Anyway, now we're dealing with the tribe of Dan, beginning with verse 40. It says, then the seventh lot fell to the tribe of the sons of Dan according to their families. The territories of their inheritance was Zorah, and Ishtaol, and Ishemesh, and Labin, and Ajalon, and Ithla, and Elon, and Timnah, and Ekron, and LTK, and Gibbethon, and Balath, and Jehud, and Ben-Ebir-Rak, and Gath-Rimmon, and Mijakon, and Rakkon, with its territories over against Joppa. You look at some of these names, and you just wonder, why in the heck can't they have names like, you know, Fair Oaks or Roseville or whatever? But, you know, these names, I think, even though a lot of them are missing now as far as history is concerned, God put them in there for a specific reason. I think that it points to, spiritually speaking, that, hey, man, nothing's going to be omitted. Remember what Jesus said? Hey, if you so much as give a cold glass of water in my name to the least of my brethren, it will not lose its reward. And we're talking about inheritance now. Now, and this interesting about the tribe of Dan. Let's just finish this up because we left off in verse 47. It says, and the territory of the sons of Dan proceeded beyond them. For the sons of Dan went up and fought with Lehem and captured it, and they struck it with the edge of the sword and possessed it and settled in it, and they called Lehem Dan after the name of Dan their father. And this was an inheritance of the tribes of the sons of Dan according to their families, these cities with their villages. When they finished apportioning the land for inheritance by its borders, the sons of Israel gave an inheritance in their midst to Joshua the son of Nun. In accordance with the command of the Lord, they gave him the city which he asked, Timnath-Serah, in the hill country of Ephraim. So he built the city and settled in it. These are the inheritances which Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun and the heads of the households of the tribes of the sons of Israel distributed by lot in Shiloh before the Lord at the doorway of the tent of meeting. So they finished dividing the land. You know, what's kind of interesting to me is they're talking now here about the tribe of Dan, and here's what's interesting about Dan. I mean, Dan, we're told in Genesis, Jacob makes a prophecy about Dan. And he said this about Dan. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a horned snake in the path that bites the horse's heel so that the rider falls backwards. And then it says, for thy salvation I wait, O Lord. In other words, you look at Dan, and I believe it was going to be from the tribe of Dan that the Antichrist is going to come. Because he says here that Dan will be a serpent in the way, a horned snake in the path that will bite the rider's heel. Dan means God will judge. In other words, the tribe of Dan is going to be the tribe that I think the Antichrist will come through to judge the world and to judge his people. But also, what I get out of this when I'm reading about this, as far as the inheritance, I think it's kind of significant because here's the tribe of Dan here. It's just this area here along the seacoast, and there's Joppa here. Dan was unable to take that land that was given to him. And eventually, a lot of the people migrated all the way up here to the very border of the northern part of Israel. And then they named this place Dan. They cut out a place for them named Dan. Because if you look at a map that is during the time of Christ, I mean, you don't even see Dan on the map. I mean, Dan became part of the Samaria. Okay, and what I'm saying here, what I'm suggesting here is that look where Dan was originally. He was right there in the midst of Israel, all right? But because he didn't diligently obey God as far as driving out the other inhabitants, he just kind of migrated up here to the very border of Israel. And we are told in the Old Testament that it was through the tribe of Dan that idolatry really crept into Israel, because they were the first ones to go into idolatry, and they were the first ones to lead others into idolatry. And another interesting thing, if you read in the seventh chapter, I believe, of the book of Revelation, where it lists the 12 tribes, where there's 12,000 from each tribe, what's kind of interesting to me is that the tribe of Dan is omitted. And there's going to be 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes of Israel that are going to make up the 144,000 that go forth and preach the gospel during the tribulation period. And Dan is omitted. But Dan as a tribe is not completely omitted, because if we read in Ezekiel, we read that when there's the millennial period and God divides up the land, Dan is back in play. But I think because of his idolatry, because he wanted to live on the fringes, on the border, rather than to possess the land that God had given him, that he was the first one to fall into idolatry. He led others into idolatry. That it's through the tribe of Dan that I think that God's going to judge the world. I think it's kind of significant. And the spiritual significance to me too is, if we're going to live on the borderline as far as our relationship with God, then we're always, I think, putting ourselves in a position where it's really easy to fall back into the world. I know. I think there's an old saying, something that the wolf doesn't bother the sheep that are closest to the shepherd. And I think that the further away we get from the shepherd, I think the easier it is for Satan to get us in his crosshairs. You know what I'm saying? So, because to keep this in mind too, I know I'm kind of over on as far as time is concerned on this chapter here, but you see where Jerusalem is? It's right here, all right? Dan was very close to Jerusalem. He migrates way up there. And then when the kingdom split between northern and southern tribes, they ended up making an altar in Dan rather than having the people go all the way down to Jerusalem. So it's kind of like that's where people really get messed up. Yeah.
So did Dan just go away there?
Well, apparently a lot of his people migrated north. Because that's what we're rereading right here, and we can see it right on the map where they named this place Dan. They didn't enter into their inheritance where God had intended for them. And I think that can happen to a lot of people, where God has rewards and he intends to give people, but they don't enter into grabbing hold of their inheritance. And so they live on the fringes or whatever. Anybody have anything you want to add to that chapter 19? I know it was a very difficult chapter to get through. Let's pick up in this chapter 20. It's not a very lengthy chapter, but I think it's a very significant chapter. It's a very fascinating chapter because it goes right along with what we read in Numbers. I think it was Numbers 35, I think, in regards to the city of refuge. Because it says here in verse 1 of chapter 20, it says, "Then the Lord spoke to Joshua, saying, Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, Designate the cities of refuge of which I spoke to you through Moses, that the manslayer who kills any person unintentionally without premeditation may flee there, and they shall become your refuge from the avenger of blood. He shall flee to one of these cities and shall stand at the entrance of the gate of the city and state his case in the hearing of the elders of that city, and they shall take him into the city to them and give him a place so that he may dwell among them. Now if the avenger of blood pursues him, then they shall not deliver the manslayer into his hand, because he struck his neighbor without premeditation and did not hate him beforehand. And he shall dwell in that city until he stands before the congregation for judgment, until the death of the one who is the high priest in those days. Then the manslayer shall return to his own city and to his own house, to the city from which he fled." So they set apart Kadesh in Galilee in the hill country of Naphtali, and Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim, and Kiriath Arbor, that is Hebron, in the hill country of Judah. And beyond the Jordan, east of Jericho, they designated Bezer in the wilderness on the plain from the tribe of Reuben, and Ramoth on Gilead from the tribe of Gad, and Golan in Bashan from the tribe of Manasseh. These were the appointed cities for all the sons of Israel and for their stranger who sojourns among them, that whoever kills any person unintentionally may flee there and not die by the hand of the avenger of blood until he stands before the congregation. Now, when we went through, and I think it was, don't quote me now, but I think it was the 35th chapter of the book of Numbers when we went through and read all about the city of refuge. And it, to me, it's really, really significant because, like I said, you look on this map here, and they divided up the cities this way. Up here, if you can see it right here, is the city of Kadesh. It's up there in the north on the left side of the Jordan, and also right about in the center, there's the city of Shechem, and there's the city of Hebron on this side. Then on the east side of the Jordan, there's the Golan, city of Golan up way up north, and then there's also the city of Ramoth-Gilead about in the center, and there's the city of Bezer. Like I said, you look at the way the cities are situated, it's very significant because they're located in such a way that if a person unintentionally killed another human being, regardless of how far away they might have been, okay, they could still get to that city in a one day's journey from the city. That's the way God located these cities, in such a way that any person who accidentally kills somebody, they could arrive at those cities within one day. Now, they were told to flee to those cities, and I think it's kind of significant. But also the cities, I think, are kind of significant because of their names. I mean, Kadesh means holiness, and Shechem means shoulder, or it's a place of strength. Hebron means fellowship, and Golan means joy, and Ramoth-Gilead means exaltation, and Bezer means fortification. You look at these cities, and they really have a powerful significance as far as the way God views taking another person's life, all right? And you tell me now, think this through. Why does God put such a tremendous premium on a human life?
Made in His image and likeness.
Exactly. We're made in His image and likeness. We're made in His image and likeness. When a person goes out and murders another person, you know what it's kind of like? Because we probably have all seen this. You notice in a lot of these on the news, you can see people in these Arab countries that will burn a president in effigy, for example. What are they really saying here? If they burn a president in effigy, you know what they're really saying? If we could get our hands on you, this is what we'll do to you. This is what they're really saying. And it's almost as though when you kill another human being and you premeditate this, it's almost as though if we could get your hands on God, this is what we do to you. Because we're made in the image and likeness of God. And I think it's a really, really serious thing when we look at it from a divine perspective. This is why when we're pushing almost 50 million murders as far as unborn children in this country. And these children are created in the image and likeness of God. Remember what Jesus said when somebody said to Jesus, "Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar?" And Jesus looked at them and says, "You hypocrites, you phony. Why are you testing me?" He says, "Give me a coin." They gave him a coin. And he says, "Whose image and whose inscription is this?" And they said, "Caesar's." "Whose image is that?" See, and then he says, "Render unto Caesar's the things that are Caesar's." and unto God the things that are God's. So it's like the coin was bearing Caesar's image. So Jesus said, give that to Caesar. That belongs to him. But whose image did we bear? We bear Jesus' image, or God's image. So that belongs to him. Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar, unto God the things that are God's. And that only God has dominion over life. Even all of life, not just human life, but all of life. That's why God said when you were to slay an animal to eat it, you were to pour out its blood. Because that, in pouring out its blood, you were showing that God had dominion over that life. You see? And here's a situation where a person kills another human being unintentionally. Unintentionally. And what happens to him? He has to go to this, go to a city and do what? He has to stay there till what happens?
The priest dies.
And the priest is the high priest. The high priest. Right? That's pointing to Jesus Christ, because you read in Hebrews, it says that Jesus Christ is our high priest. He's from the order of Melchizedek. And so when Jesus Christ died, I mean, he took his blood into heaven, because in heaven there's a temple and there's a Holy of Holies and there's an Ark of the Covenant, because everything that was created by Moses down here and Solomon was after a pattern that's in heaven. And Jesus took his blood up there. And it was through his shedding of blood. It's when he died, all right, that gave us forgiveness of sins. So these cities point to Jesus Christ. If we go to the city, we are in the city, we are safe in the city. But if we leave the city for any reason, then we are told that the manslayer, now who's the manslayer? The manslayer is the closest kin to the person that was killed. He had a moral obligation before God to take this other person's life. Because, why? Because he was under the law. The law says an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, bone for bone, break for break, life for life. Here's the thing. It said they had to flee to the city. All right? He had to drop everything and just flee. That says a lot, as far as I'm concerned, because it's like he couldn't dilly-dally around, because his life was in jeopardy now. All right? In the New Testament, we're told to flee immorality, to flee temptation, and to flee various things. And if we don't, we put ourselves in jeopardy. Like if a person accidentally killed somebody, went to a city as a refuge, and then he decided, you know what, I'm going to sneak out of here, go see my girlfriend or whatever. Well, once he leaves that city of refuge, he's no longer under protection. And the same thing with us. When we flee to Christ and we are in him, we abide in him, we are under the blood, we are under that protection. All right? But if we get out from under Christ, if we get away from that city, then we're fair game. Because who's the blood avenger? Who does that really point to? What does it really point to?
The law.
It points to the law. The blood avenger points to the law, because the law says, hey, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, bone for bone, break for break, life for life. So in other words, you've gotten yourself out of that city of refuge, which points to Christ. You're no longer abiding in that city of refuge. And you, once you get outside that city of refuge, if you, you are fair game. Anybody even want to add or share to that? But I tell you what I do. You know, we still got 15 minutes, and this is a chapter that just deals with the priests, and it deals with a lot of these different cities, but it's pretty darn redundant. So why don't we just go through it? Keep this in mind. It's going to go through 42 different cities that are going to be given to the Levites. They've already been given these six cities, the cities of refuge. So there's 48 cities in all. And God goes to great length in describing, or basically meting out these various cities that the Levites are going to now occupy. But here's the thing, and I think I've mentioned it when we went through the book of Numbers. When the priests are given these cities, I think it's very significant, because wherever there's a city, you find a high concentration of people. Wherever you find a high concentration of people, what do you find? A high concentration of sin, a higher concentration of crime and of immorality and prostitution and drug abuse and, you know, all kinds of different things, you know, murders, this type of thing. Well, the priests were to live in the cities. They were to act as the salt of the earth, the leaven-foot society, the light of the world. And they were to have this arresting effect upon sin in the cities. Anyway, beginning at verse 1 in chapter 21, it says, then the heads of the households of the Levites approached Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun, and the heads of the households of the tribes of the sons of Israel, and they spoke to them at Shiloh in the land of Cana, saying, the Lord commanded through Moses to give us the cities to live in with their pasture lands for our cattle. So the sons of Israel gave the Levites from their inheritance these cities with their pasture lands according to their command of the Lord. Then the lot came out for the families of the Kohathites, and the sons of Aaron, the priest, who were of the Levites, received 13 cities by lot from the tribes of Judah, and from the tribes of the Simeonites, and from the tribe of Benjamin. And the rest of the sons of Kohath received 10 cities by lot from the families of the tribe of Ephraim, from the tribe of Dan, and from the half the tribe of Manasseh. And the sons of Gershom, now before we go any further, just keep something in mind as far as the Kohathites are concerned. Levi had three sons, okay? It was, he had Kohath and Gershom and Merai. And these three different sons, from their descendants, they divided up the tribe of Levi into these three different categories, and the Kohathites had the responsibility, the obligation of carrying all of the sacred articles of the tabernacle, and they also had the responsibility to act as high priest and priest in terms of offering incense and putting out the showbread and lighting the candles within the sanctuary. Okay, so they had a very specific job, but they're, you know, this is why when you're reading this, the tribe of Levi is divided up into three categories. So just keep that in mind in case it seems a little confusing. But he, in that verse 6, he says, then the sons of Gershom received 13 cities by lot from the families of the tribe of Issachar, and from the tribe of the Asher, and from the tribe of Naphtali, and from the half the tribe of Manasseh in Bashan. Then the sons of Merari, according to their families, received 12 cities from the tribe of Reuben, and from the tribe of Gad, and from the tribe of Zebulun. Now the sons of Israel gave by lot to the Levites these cities with their pasture lands, as the Lord had commanded through Moses. And they gave these cities, which are here mentioned by name, from the tribe of the sons of Judah, and from the tribe of the sons of Simeon. And they were from the sons of Aaron, one of the families of the Kohathites, of the sons of Levi, for the lot was theirs first. Thus they gave them Kiriath Arba, and Arba being the father of Anak, that is Hebron, in the hill country of Judah with its surrounding pasture lands. Now, Kiriath Arba, that was another name for Hebron. Remember, that was given to who? Anybody remember? It was given to Caleb. All right, and Caleb is the one that conquered that, because that was the land of the sons of Anak. That's where the giants dwell. But Caleb said, "Hey, give me this mountain. This is what God promised me." And he went in and completely defeated these people of great size. And then Caleb turns around and gives the priest the city of Hebron. And you see, the type of person that Caleb is. I mean, Caleb means bold one. Some people say it means dog, but it basically can mean lion or dog in the sense that he was bold. He had great faith, and he just believed God, and God just blessed him enormously. And also, remember what happened when Caleb did conquer that land? He says, anybody that could take this particular city that he mentioned will get my daughter as his wife. And so this guy named Othniel went forth, and he, conquered the city. And I thought that's kind of significant, because Caleb wasn't going to give his daughter to any Tom, Dick, or Harry. He wanted somebody that really proved himself as a man. And so, this whole land there that he's talking about was basically Caleb's. And Caleb turns around and gives, a significant portion of it to the priest. And he says in verse 12, and it says, but the fields of the city and its villages they gave to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and his possessions. So the sons of Aaron, the priest, they gave Hebron, the city of refuge, for the manslayer, with his pasture lands, and Libna and its pasture lands, and Jattir with its pasture lands, and Ishtimoah and its pasture lands, and Holon and its pasture lands, and Deber and its pasture lands, and Ain and its pasture lands, and Jutta and its pasture lands, and Beth Shemesh and its pasture lands, 9 cities from these 2 tribes, and from the tribe of Benjamin, Gibeon and its pasture lands, Geba and its pasture lands, Anathoth and its pasture lands, and Almon and its pasture lands, 4 cities, and all the cities of the sons of Aaron, the priests, were 13 cities with their pasture lands. Then the cities from the tribe of Ephraim were allotted to the families of the sons of Kohath, the Levites, even to the rest of the sons of Kohath, and they gave them Shechem, the city of refuge, for the manslayer, with his pasture lands in the hill country of Ephraim, and Gezer with his pasture lands, and Kibzaim and his pasture lands, and Beth Horon and his pasture lands, 4 cities, and from the tribe of Dan, LTK and its pasture lands, and Gibbethon and its pasture lands, and Ajilon and its pasture lands, and Geth Rimon and its pasture lands, 4 cities, and for the half the tribe of Manasseh, they allotted Tanach and its pasture lands, and Gath Rimmon and its pasture lands, two cities, and all the cities with their pasture lands. For the families of the rest of the sons of Kohath were 10. It says, and to the sons of Gershom, one of the families of the Levites, from the half of the tribe of Manasseh, they gave Golan in Bashan, the city of refuge, for the manslayer with his pasture lands, and Beth-Turah with his pasture lands, two cities, and from the tribe of Issachar, they gave Kishion and his pasture lands, and Debirath and his pasture lands, Jamurth and its pasture lands, and Ganim and its pasture lands, four cities. And for the tribe of Asher, they gave Mishal and its pasture lands, Abdon and its pasture lands, Helkath and its pasture lands, and Rehob and its pasture lands, four cities. And from the tribe of Naphtali, they gave Kadesh in Galilee, the city of the refuge for the manslayer, and its pasture lands, and Hamath Dor with its pasture lands, and Carthan and its pasture lands, three cities. All the cities of the Gershonites, according to their families, were 13 cities with their pasture lands. And to the families of the sons of Merari, the rest of the Levites, they gave from the tribe of Zebulun, Jokneam and its pasture lands, Kartha and its pasture lands, Dibna and its pasture lands, Halal and his pasture lands, four cities. And from the tribe of Reuben, they gave Bezer and his pasture lands, and Jahaz and his pasture lands, Kedemoth and his pasture lands, and Mephaeth and his pasture lands, four cities. And from the tribe of Gad, they gave Ramah in Gilead, the city of refuge for the manslayer, with his pasture lands, and Mahanaim and his pasture lands, Hebron with his pasture lands, Jazer with his pasture lands, four cities in all. All these were the cities of the sons of Merari according to their families. The rest of the families of the Levites and their lot was 12 cities. All the cities of Levites in the midst of the possession of the sons of Israel were 48 cities with their pasture lands. These cities each having a surrounding pasture land. Thus it was with all these cities. So the Lord gave Israel all the land which he had sworn to give their fathers, and they possessed it and lived in it. And the Lord gave them rest on every side according to all that he had sworn to their fathers, and no one of their enemies stood before them. The Lord gave all their enemies into their hand. Not one of the good promises which the Lord had made to the house of Israel failed. All came to pass. Now, the reason I read that whole thing through is because you see the redundancy there? Again and again and again it says, and their pasture lands, and their pasture lands. You know, you got to ask yourself why. Why did the Holy Spirit go through such lengths to constantly, after every city that they were given, it said, in their pasture land. What's the spiritual significance to that? What's it really pointing to?
God's provision.
Well, put it this way. These are priests, right? Okay? These are the spiritual leaders. In a symbolic sense, you go into a church, you see a pastor, a minister, a priest, he has his pasture with his flock, all right? That's what he's responsible for. And God puts a tremendous emphasis upon that. These people had tremendous responsibility as far as their spiritual responsibility was concerned. They were given 48 cities. They had to live in the cities, but what was their primary responsibility? They had to teach the people about God. They had to teach the people about His laws, His statutes, His ordinances. They try to instill in people a love and a knowledge and a fear of God. That's their pasture land. You see what I'm driving at here? You know, we got pastors, ministers, priests today. They have a pasture land. Well, what are they doing with their pasture land? What are they doing as far as their flock are concerned? You know, because Jesus basically looked at the pasture land when he was, walking the earth, and he felt sorry for the people because he said they're like sheep without a shepherd. So I think that the emphasis here over and over again, like I said, it may seem pretty redundant, pretty monotonous, pretty repetitious, but hey, you got to ask yourself, why does the Holy Spirit go to such lengths? What is he trying to say here? What he's trying to say is, hey, you know what? You have a tremendous responsibility as my priest when it comes to these pasture lands, all right? You've got to shepherd your flock and shepherd them in such a way that they're going to be able to grow and to be protected and to become spiritually mature. And this, in closing, I think that he says a couple of things that I think are pretty significant, because read this verse 44. Because when you read this, you tell me what's wrong with this verse. And the Lord gave them rest on every side according to all that he had sworn to their fathers, and no one of their enemies stood before them. The Lord gave all their enemies into their hand. Now, What seems contradictory in that verse? Keep something in mind. Didn't we just say that Dan had a hard time, you know, subduing their land, so they migrated north? And then Ephraim was saying, remember when we read about their situation, they were saying, hey man, we can't go down the valley because they've got chariots down there. And basically Joshua was telling them, hey, go into the hill country, man, clear out the trees and, you know, roll up your sleeves, go to work. They wanted a bigger portion where they didn't have to work for it. Other tribes did the same thing. In other words, remember, keep that in mind. When Joshua went in and conquered this land, he basically broke the back of all the resistance. Joshua was like a prefigurement of Christ. He was a type of Christ. Christ has broken the back of the powers of darkness. But guess what? We're in up to our eyeballs in a spiritual warfare, aren't we? It's not like just Christ did all the crying and all the dying and we're just going to be carried to heaven on a flowery beds of ease. No. We have to, you know, work out our salvation with fear and trembling. We're in the midst of this spiritual battle, this spiritual warfare, and it's a knockdown, drag out fight with the devil, and with the world, with the flesh, or whatever. And if we dig in our heels and we obey God, hey, all of His promises are going to come to pass. And if wherever we obey God, our enemies can't stand before us. But if we're going to, let's say, flee, what's going to happen to us? We are told in the New Testament, okay, flee immorality and flee idolatry and flee fornication. But it also tells us to do what? To resist what?
The devil.
To resist the devil. And he will do what?
He'll
flee from you, right? When these people did not resist, when these people did not apply themselves, well, God was no longer obligated to fulfill His promise. But everywhere that they obeyed Him, especially you can see it with Caleb, you know, Caleb just believed God, went in there and wiped out his enemies. But when people dilly-dallied around, and instead of wiping out, you know, these people that were under God's judgment, and instead some of them were just subdued them, made them slaves or whatever, big mistake. Because eventually they became thorns in their side, they became cinders in their eyes, they became, you know, a stumbling block to them. But when you read that last couple of verses there, what it's really saying is, hey, everywhere that these people obeyed God, their enemies could not stand before them. Anybody have anything to add or share what we read tonight? You know, some of these names, I just dread it.
All the names are little villages and cities.
Cities, okay. And but keep in mind, they're not big, huge metropolises like we've got today. You know, a city is a walled-in enclosure. It didn't have to be that darn big either.
I mean, if you're in that tribe, could you go to the other tribe? I mean, can people go back and forth?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They're free to move around.
Yeah. You could go anywhere you wanted. Okay. Go ahead. What?
Just like the family's
just like
land.
You know, there was like all these tribes, but how did you know which tribe you belonged to?
Oh.
It's like your family.
Well,
you know who
you're
They don't put it this way. They had meticulous records back then.
Okay.
And they started out in Egypt with 70 people, and everybody knew what tribe. It's kind of like your last name. Okay, Barry. Okay, here's all the Barrys. Or here's all the Hunts. So they knew what tribe they belonged to. All right? But today, of course, most of them don't know, have a clue. But God certainly knows.
And it's kind of like, okay, they're being taught about God. And I just, it's like, where did it go all wicky-wacky to get us where we are today?
Look at us. This nation was founded on God. Look, I mean, same thing happened to them. When we get into the book of Samuel, the book of Kings... The problem is this, man. We have a bent in us that gravitates to sin, gravitates to doing our own thing, our self-will. But what else? We got the devil. He's always there. You know what I'm saying? And so we got a lot of things going against us. And what's the biggest thing that we have going against us? The biggest thing.
I'd say it's our self.
It, what part of ourselves?
It's our ego. It's our pride.
In Jeremiah 17, it says, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked, that nobody can really know the hidden motives of the heart but the Lord. In other words, our heart is our biggest problem. Our heart is deceitful above all things. Our heart can plead the purity of anything. Okay, I don't care whether it's mass murder or abortion or whatever. You see, our heart will deceive us. That's the biggest thing we got going against us, is our own heart. You know what I'm saying? And that's why we need a change. You need to change your heart. You need a new life. Become a new creature in Christ. And, you know, Anyway, let's go ahead and close with prayer. Lord, we just look to you in prayer right now. Thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to read your word tonight. It is very difficult reading. A lot of it was just trip, stumbling, and falling all over these difficult names. But I refuse to omit these things. I'm just going to bite into it anyway. Because you're the one that said, man does not live on bread alone, but every word that proceeded from the mouth of God. And you had this recorded for a very specific purpose. So even though it's hard to chew some of this stuff, I nevertheless just pray that none of us will leave here the same that we came in, that we can leave here different than we arrived, that we leave here with a deeper sense of your presence in our life, a deeper love and appreciation of you and of each other. Anyway, I just pray that you anoint it anyway. Go forth on the internet. It won't return to you void, that it will really make a difference in people's lives. And again, we just commit unto you all of the personal prayer requests that we have. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.